Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
The following is a presentation of the Four Center podcast feed.
From the center of the galaxy, this is the Four Center podcast feed, and this particular episode of the Four Center podcast feed is the Clone Wars Report. Every week, I am more entertained by your musical selections to capture the mood of the Clone Wars Report. And that was like some sultry guitar, maybe?
Like a sultry noir sax guitar, but sweeping romance ballad? I don't know.
I definitely sensed the romance because these are, in my opinion, some of the most romantic episodes of the Clone Wars. Romantic fighting of small droid spider creatures. That's what romance is in Star Wars. You fight little droid spiders together.
Yeah. Oh, the romance of droid spiders.
Back to back in love. That's we're talking about Obi-Wan and Satine. You can imagine that Ken and I are back to back as we record this podcast. As we always like to do, we're letting you know what episodes we're actually talking about so you can join in. We talk about the arcs. So sometimes that's a single episode. And this week it is three episodes. It is season 2, episode 12, The Mandalore Plot, written by Melinda Shu, directed by Kyle Dunleavy. Then season 2, episode 13, Voyage of Temptation, written by Paul Dini, directed by Brian Kalin O'Connell. And season 2, episode 14, Duchess of Mandalore, written by Drew Z. Greenberg, directed by Brian Kalin O'Connell. They definitely form an arc. They're a little trilogy, but they're all each their own episode, right, Ken?
Oh, yeah. The little individual vibe, especially by Duchess of Mandalore, where, you know, where little Palpatine comes in. Voyage of Temptation. I mean, that's just you want pulpy. That's what that is. And overall, yeah, it all connects so well. Such great episodes.
Yeah, so we're going to dive in. We're going to do a summary. I like writing these summaries, and I like sharing them. Are you ready, Ken?
Let's do it.
Neutrality. The leader of Mandalore, Duchess Satine Kriaz, is also the leader of the Council of Neutral Systems, over 1,500 worlds who are determined to stay out of the Clone Wars. Little does Satine know, a Separatist and Sith plot is afoot. Following a deadly civil war, Satine ushered in a new era for Mandalore, emphasizing pacifism and non-violent political action. Angered at the rejection of traditional Mandalorian warrior ways, a group of extremists called the Death Watch plot a violent takeover of Mandalore. Aided by Dooku and Palpatine, Death Watch makes multiple attempts to murder and or frame Satine. All to justify a Republic occupation of Mandalore. They know this would turn the proud and independent people of Mandalore against the Republic. The people would then see the Death Watch as liberators, not terrorists. And so, Satine engages in a mostly nonviolent battle for the will of her people and the future of Mandalore. She is both aided and frustrated by the assistance of Jedi peacekeeper Obi-Wan Kenobi. The spark of Kenobi and Satine's youthful romance is rekindled, and the star-crossed friends, but not lovers, wrestle with what it truly means to keep the peace. Satine is also aided by the political savvy of Padme Amidala and the casual violence of Anakin Skywalker. Together, they expose just enough of the plot to foil it, and Mandalore remains a place of neutrality and pacifism for now. Bum, bum, bum.
Mm-hmm. For now.
Yeah. Yeah. This one was such an interesting trilogy of episodes, because there's the individual plot mechanics of each individual episode, but all of it is framed by that one big plot of let's get the Republic to occupy Mandalore, which is just such a great statement on the war itself.
A Mandalore plot.
Yeah. So let's get into your overall reaction, Ken. Did you love these episodes, like them, struggle with them? Where did you go?
Yeah, I mean, come on. This is the stuff, right? I mean, this is, if you're having a casual conversation at a bar and Clone Wars comes up. Clone Wars, what are some of your favorite moments or episodes? There's going to be so many, you're going to be overwhelmed. And you're going to go, oh, but you know what? I totally remember the Mandalore stuff and Duchess Satine. This comes up a lot for good reason. Big canon stuff, big revelations, big private investigator Kenobi energy, which we love. It's not just about choosing sides or the war coming to you. That's all through it. It's about culture change. It's about, like you said, how to keep the peace. Some great philosophy going on. And final note for me here, I just love the use of Kenobi to really dig into the hard questions of the war and the Jedi. Among other things, there's a lot of things that are brought up here. Because, you know, to me, Ahsoka's still learning. Anakin might already be compromised. We always kind of say Kenobi's kind of that poster child for the Jedi in a way. Not saying he's always perfect, but just that, yeah, you look at him, you go, that guy gets it, and he knows what he's doing. He's knows what he's there for, and he does good things. And now you got some real tough questions that he's got to analyze and answer. And I love all that at play in these episodes.
Yeah, no, I absolutely echo a ton of what you're saying. I love these episodes partially because of just my deep love for Kenobi, but it's always great to take a step back and look at all three episodes because there's so much going on in these episodes, from the revelation of Kenobi's relationship with Satine to, you know, this is the first time we're really seeing this, you know, this canon version of Mandalore, and now it ripples out, and these are some episodes to rewatch if you really like the show The Mandalorian, right? Mm-hmm. So there's so many like bits of canon, specific scenes, specific lines that I think fans remember and like, but it's always fun to rewatch it and just be reminded that all three together are basically a huge political thriller, right? Like that's the actual story that is motivating all of these great moments of Kenobi and Mandalorian canon. And I love the vibe. It's great. If you had just written on a piece of paper, turns out Obi-Wan is going to have had somebody he was romantically interested in his youth, and then he re-encounters them. I'd be like, great, that's all in. I'm all in on that. But the execution of it, that Kenobi and Satine are kind of like this old Hollywood romance that's going on between these two stubborn, bantering, star-crossed lovers. And I really love that their dynamic is not like that opposites attract. It's more like similars attract, that they are both very similar people with very similar concerns and nobility, and they're just getting together and pushing each other to live up to their own ideals. And that works so well just as in a relationship. But what's so great about it to me is that the big picture, like political thriller, is that both the Jedi and the Mandalorians have to wrestle with their relationship to violence and their history of violence. And that big picture story gets to be told through this personal story of Obi-Wan and Satine, of this is how we relate, is by poking at each other and holding each other to our highest values. And through that, we're holding our own people, our own culture, to these higher values.
Mm, yeah, that's all just some great storytelling, great writing. And you're right, just a simple concept, I guess you could put down on paper, but you could take this so many different ways and go wrong or maybe not have the impact. It works on every level, works on that sweeping romance. And I love, oh, you're so right, the Jedi, the Mandalorians, it's not quite Romeo and Juliet. It's its own version, Kenobi and Satine. I mean, Obi-Wan and Satine, that's why people love it and react to it so much. So a lot of things at play there, and of course it should end up with the war. This is the Clone Wars, and it's a mirror reflected to everyone in the story and us, and that's why I think they work so well as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Final thing that I wanted to say for myself in the big picture review is just all three episodes are great. I think that second episode I might like point to that as one of my favorite individual episodes of the Clone Wars. I think it's partially because that's where we really get the depth of the Kenobi and Satine relationship. Mm-hmm. We get the hint that they knew each other in the first episode, and we get a little bit of their trying to reconnect in particular in the third episode. But the second episode is where it all comes spilling out, right? And I love that the adventure is, you know, the whiz bang Star Wars adventure part of it is there are droids down in the darkness underneath that can't be contained. And even when you think you stop them, more small versions spill out. And like the spider droids are just this like incredibly beautifully not subtle, analogy for repressed emotions. It's like those spider droids are like Obi-Wan and Satine's feelings. Like they're coming up from the depths and they're going to keep crawling out no matter what. So I love that. And, you know, I think it is notable that this is scripted by Paul Dini. Obviously, the whole team, Clone Wars team, is involved creatively. But just the actual script, not even the story, not the themes, but the script, the dialogue has an extra sharpness. It almost has a hunger to me of like somebody who's like, I love Star Wars and this is my moment where I get to play and I'm going to really, really, you know, just tear into it and make sure that every line is special. Not a single line is throwaway or unconsidered.
Yeah, absolutely. And Paul Dini, who's such a wonderful career, that's influenced a lot of folks, a lot of properties. I love that this is kind of like, not that he couldn't take a big swipe now, but like this was the time for him to like get into Star Wars for what you're saying there. That's like it's great for him to roll up his sleeves and go, let me turn my eye to this. It works.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a flavor to some of the lines. Some of them are just like great quotable lines, which I'm sure we'll quote, but some of them have the flavor of that perspective of like, I've always wondered about this and this Star Wars idea, and I want to poke at this Star Wars idea, and it's a real sense of fun and play along with the depth.
Yeah.
So let's dive into the morals of the episode, Ken. We got three episodes, three morals. If you ignore the past, you jeopardize the future. Good. Fear not for the future, weep not for the past. Great. It'd be a fun Hallmark card to send someone. And finally, in war, truth is the first casualty. Which of these morals hit you? What did you think about when you heard them? All that stuff.
So I think the one that hit me, the one I've been ruminating and thinking on, perhaps dumped to my Scrabble bag of notes on down on the thing, you know, just a lot of letters I'm putting into sentences here. First one, if you ignore the past, you jeopardize the future. I think they all work well together. In War, Truth is the First Casualty is very interesting. Just the idea of plots and intrigue, conspiracies, inflame passions, and how information is used to drive things forward, for better or worse, maybe, which is why I put the note of enter Palpatine. This is when he really needed to show up. So that one's good. Fear not for the future, weep not for the past is very much connected to the first one for me. But I'll just throw it up there. I just the idea of if you ignore the past, you jeopardize the future. So this is taking in parts of learning from it, growing from it. I can't help, and I'm going to probably mention a few times, I can't help but think about Kylo Ren and his big thesis of episode 8 that, you know, got missed and misinterpreted and twisted, depending on how you wanted to use that in an argument. Let the past die and everything about that there. But also this is, you were talking about culture change. You talked about the Jedi and the Mandalorians having to deal with what they were, what they're tied to. You said violence, because that's very much what it is, the Jedi Mandalorian wars, right? Mm-hmm. So then I have to wonder too, it's like, this is a question. This isn't me saying a statement of, you got a little bit in this, in the first episode, Duchess Satine is, I don't want to say like overlooking Death Watch or playing it down for Kenobi. Who knows? Trying to get it there, but not that we are legitimizing what the Death Watch believe or what they want, but they think they represent a truth. And I think you can't just simply ignore that. You have to take that and grow from it. And I don't think Satine's killing the past. I think that's what Kylo wanted to do and why it ties into that. So it's just this big soup of philosophy and viewpoints, and how do you actually affect true change, which is something that she has done and is continuing to do, or continuing to try to do, and this is a big obstacle to it.
Yeah, no, I think everything you're saying is great. I feel like in War, Truth is the First Casualty. Sometimes these morals are sort of they're philosophical, right? Or they're good rules of thumb. If you're fighting in a galactic space war, or if you're, you know, just trying to coach a little league team, as you have pointed out,
sometimes
they're good all purpose. This is almost more like, hey, this is literally what's happening in the episode, and this is literally what happens in the world. This is a literal thing that happens. You know, it really goes to me. I think there's so much in the Clone Wars, it's in these episodes where we know the story of individuals who give into their fear and fall. And I think what the Clone Wars tells us again and again is, hey, you know, Anakin's journey, that exact journey happens to societies. You know, you give in to half-truths that expose your fear and you respond to the fear, you know. And I think that one is really just right on the nose, right on Palpatine's nose. And the other two, I love what you're saying. They're both wrestling with a theme of Star Wars, which I think is that generational change.
Yeah.
That the past and the future are this duality of Star Wars, and we're always in the present, somehow caught between the two. I think it really plays into that big Star Wars theme of the past does not stay buried. You can't kill the past. You need to deal with it and learn from it, right? Because the violent Mandalorians are coming back. The Sith are coming back. The Jedi are falling into a war like they haven't been in, you know, an extremely long time. Obi-Wan's and Satine's feelings are coming back. The past does not stay buried. So, you know, I think that's a lot of what if you ignore the past, you jeopardize the future is about. And then the second one is almost like a response to that of, you know, fear not for the future, weep not for the past, is really that, you know, you can't change the past, so you have to accept it. And you can't just always be in constant anxiety about the future, the way Anakin is in anxiety about those visions of Padme. You have to be in the moment and dealing with what's in front of you.
It's also a great Sarah McLachlan song, sort of. You're absolutely right. And to maybe more clarify even what I'm thinking about the Death Watch too, of just like you said, you have to deal with that, right? You keep saying that so wonderfully, just like this is the nature. And so you can't overlook that anything there, because if you just kind of brush it off, you're going to jeopardize the future, because then they, in this case, the Death Watch, will probably jeopardize that future. So that's part of what's on the table for me as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to dig into those ideas. I want to talk about all the big picture ideas of the episodes. Mm-hmm. What do you think are a couple of the big picture ideas at stake in the episode? What does your Scrabble bag say?
Scrabble bag says, read the tea leaves here. I tell you what, I kind of combine the war truth is the first casualty thing is, yeah, not its own thing. It I think it's in fact, actually, so I'm thinking aloud. I think it asks you to examine some of the lessons maybe learned in the first two. I just put down this idea of these episodes, and what's at stake is this idea of what defines you and then what drives you forward. And you have two groups, but I broke it up in three categories. You have a Jedi, you have a pacifist, and who is leading the Mandalorians. And all three of these parties and individuals or groups here, Jedi, Mandalorians, and then Kenobi, Satine, and perhaps even Death Watch, maybe are asking themselves, what defines me and what has defined me? And how am I going to take that to move me forward? And how do I want to move forward? This idea that Satine says, is reality what makes the Jedi abandon his ideals, or is it simply a response to political convenience? Great line. Ooh, sharp dig, right? Makes you think. I just took that to a lot of things. I think Kenobi's got some interesting, I like what Kenobi kind of says at one point about saying, what's the line? A noble description, he says, when she talks about the role of peacekeepers, and a noble description, but not a realistic one. And Satine kind of wonders back to him, do the Jedi bend to what's in front of them, which is what I think that line means. So all of that is goes back to this theme for me of find out what defines you and how are you going to go forward with that and make the changes that are needed or make the changes you want. And then when challenged, what are you going to be? What will you become, as Saw Gerrera says in a trailer? You ever saw beyond that, you know?
The great themes of moments that got cut out of the films. Yeah, no, I'm totally on board with you. I think that's where my mind went to. I kind of saw it as the big picture umbrella idea of being keeping the peace. The idea of what is it to be a peacekeeper as individuals and as societies. You know, I really went to that conversation as well. In that first episode where it could just feel like, oh, this is some fun banter between Obi-Wan and Satine that kind of sets the mood. But I think it really starts to play through in all their actions, you know, to break it down into the practical debate from those great quotes that you pulled is they're having this debate about what is a peacekeeper. And Obi-Wan basically says, well, they have to be on the front lines dealing with conflict. So a peacekeeper kind of can't act until there is conflict. And Satine says, no, a peacekeeper should be making sure conflict doesn't happen in the first place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think these are things that at different points in the episodes, they could almost flip and say to one another. And I think what's so great about that first episode that sets up this debate between them as people and about their societies is we get to see that they're both, you know, very, very noble and very, you know, wrestling with this important question of like, we know that keeping peace is good. We know that pacifism is the ideal. How do we get there? Mm-hmm. And they're both initially full of pride and confidence in their own people. You know, Obi-Wan's like, look, we've been through this. The Jedi and the Republic have been through this. The war started. More people are going to die if we don't act in defense while this conflict is happening. So we got to go. And at the same time, Satine's like, but look at the Mandalorians. We're doing great. I have instituted peace. And what? The Death Watch isn't that big of a deal. It's so important that she's not wanting to accept that there are dark forces in the midst of the Mandalorians, the same way she has such clarity that the Republic and the Jedi have lost their way in a way that Obi-Wan can't entirely see because they're both in the middle of their cultures, you know? And then I think their actual actions, what happens in the next couple episodes, are them both just really wrestling with this kind of big picture idea of, well, peacekeeping is defense. They seem to agree on that, but when is defense truly defense? You know, can you be tricked into defending at the wrong time or for the wrong reason? You know, when is the right time to defend, before or after the aggression? And they have to like literally kind of march through these steps in the conflicts that they themselves are find themselves in.
Yeah, and in that second episode, A Voyage of Temptation, and you know, it was a wonderful, sexy, salacious title, but I really think it comes down, it's really about this stuff. And that final standoff, which we'll, I'm sure, mention with the you know, third party Anakin getting involved, but with them and Merrick, I mean, it all builds to that and asking these big, twin, tough questions. And I understand where Obi-Wan's coming from. I get it. Oh, well, it's not very realistic. He's very, at times, he would use the phrase, delusions of a dreamer is used in the episode. I can't remember that. Maybe that's not Kenobi's quote. But I love there may be two sides to every dilemma, but the Duchess only favors hers. I mean, really Barbie stuff, really jabs and barbs, but finding the way, the right way to do it, and to one of the themes that I think has come up in some of your conversations here for Center lately, Joseph, about like, especially with the Jedi, just like the idea of both sides agree, both sides are trying. You get some credit for that, and let's find the best way forward.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree. That's it totally builds that Merrick moment really well. I think we've got this sort of a stop along the way where Satine is, you know, really right in criticizing Obi-Wan about some of the flaws of the Jedi. We know those well. We, the audience, get to know those. Obi-Wan is right that the Death Watch is more than just hooligans. I love that that's the word that she uses. Like, they're just hooligans. Actually, yeah. They're kind of a problem. And it builds to that great moment in the second episode where they are fighting back to back, and there's, you know, some great stuff going on there. And Satine says, just because I'm a pacifist doesn't mean I won't defend myself. And Obi-Wan says, now you sound like a Jedi.
Yeah.
And that's that great moment. It sounds like just fun banter, but it's that great moment where they come together, where Obi-Wan is like, see, this is what I've been living with constantly. The galaxy is in conflict, and I can sit back and not be involved, or I can try to go out there and make the choice that is defense and stop conflict and bring peace. And it's not always that simple. And, you know, there's seems to be like Satine having, you know, some little bit of understanding to it, in which then leads directly to the end of that episode, which you were so right to highlight, of Tal Merrick putting them in that compromising position and really making it about the big picture philosophy and their personal relationship of like, okay, in theory, taking me out is absolutely just and defensible because I'm one person putting the greater good at risk. I'm going to kill all these people, but I know both you pacifists, you peacekeepers, you've got yourself tied up in knots, and you'll, you know, even disappoint one another in your personal relationship if you do anything, is so great. He says, come on then, who will strike first and brand themselves as a cold-blooded killer?
Oh. Greg Proops, and so well. So
Greg
well.
Proops, right?
Yeah,
right?
Greg Proops. Yeah.
Great performance. And then I love that that's just resolved by that's not a head scratcher for Anakin, that he just kills him and says, what? He was going to blow up the ship. And it's almost a comedy beat, right? It's like,
oh, yeah, it is.
It's a comedy beat immediately followed by a mournful hint of the Imperial theme, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Go ahead.
And then Anakin immediately senses the vibe between Obi-Wan and Satine and gets kind of embarrassed. So it's like, it's this great moment of comedy. Violence foreshadowing the horror of Anakin, but also kind of having a perspective on this debate that Obi-Wan and Satine are like, we're trying to prove to one another that we are pacifists to the point where we're maybe not going to take action to save the ship.
Yeah.
You know, and it invites that discussion of like, is there a perspective where Anakin is right? But certainly not with the casualness with which he did it, right?
Yeah, look, this is a big moment. Because I'm like, I might be in Anakin's side here, which might not be a good thing. I might have to go analyze. Let me go to the cabin and think about that. No, I put down this note of, you know, if the big theme is you got to find what defines you and what drives you forward. I think Anakin does this kill because he's unsure of what defines him and unsure of how to go forward. He knows himself. He thinks he knows himself, but there's so much going through his head. It's easy to push him around, right? Palpatine, it takes him. He's pulling him on a string. And so that's why I think he, to me, makes that decision. It's you know, he knows. And again, he's got a reason to what? He was going to kill a lot of people. You know, Anakin's not wrong. But the music playing, it's one of the best uses of the Imperial March. It is played for a comedy beat for a beat. So yeah, great stuff. You know, like I said, when it happened this time around, when it happened, I'm like, yeah, that's right. Oh, wait, I don't know if I should be rooting for Anakin.
Yeah, this is real. We've been talking about straight line Anakin, who just like rips away the complexity of things, right?
Right.
And I think this is a moment where we're really invited to think about Obi-Wan and Satine's perspective. I think is the moral high ground, right? Of like, we need to make sure that we've exhausted every other possibility. And like, maybe they could cut his hand off. Maybe they could have reasoned with him and offered him some, you know, way out of it. Maybe there's some motivation they don't know about that Tal Merrick particularly has. Maybe they can make a deal with him. Who knows? Maybe Obi-Wan can somehow sacrifice himself to save everybody else. You know, there were probably still some other possibilities, maybe. And Anakin doesn't wait for those to play out. He's just like, yeah, that seems complex.
Well, never
lightsaber through the heart.
Yeah. Well, also, you're making me think of Clone Wars season 7, where Obi-Wan's like, yeah, we could have got information from Dooku. Anakin killed him.
Yeah. And he's been doing that a lot. Yeah.
You've mentioned a few times, and I think good time to address it. There's so much great banter and classic romantic banter and 1950s, Hepburn Bogart banter, and that's a Han and Leia have that, and that's such a key part of Star Wars, and it is here, it is present all through, and it's real funny. But I think these are some of the episodes where, not even on this rewatch, but like at some point in the last 4 or 5 years, I remember going back to these episodes and going, oh man, there's so much here. Like, you don't want to get just lost on the surface of the banter. It's just that's to the writing, to the excellent writing, to just use something we're used to, romantic. You know, Indiana Jones adventures. It's whiz bang adventures with some sweeping romance, but it's every line has these great thoughts, these great questions, and sometimes maybe clear answers, sometimes not. And again, I want to shout out the writing.
Yeah, I can't wait to discuss some of the favorite comedy lines and see what we picked out for the good banter. But yeah, it's all great banter that has great meaning. And again, that absolute fun of two characters who are like, we just spark, right? That clearly they did when they were kids, and clearly they do now, and they spark partially because they're just like, I don't know, it's almost like they're so similar of like, just they want to sit down and like hold hands and debate philosophy. Yeah. And they would probably, you know, the only thing that they find to poke at one another about is where they both fail to hold themselves to the highest moral possibility. But for this like big arc between them, I like that the fact that they were both in utter turmoil about Merrick successfully, pressing on the sore spot of, great, you're in a war. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill everybody on this ship. How do you get out of that now, you peace lovers? The fact that both Obi-Wan and Satine were in torment over that seems to have brought them together a little bit by the end of the episode, where, you know, Obi-Wan says, the needs of your people are all that matter. They couldn't be in better hands with you to guide their future. And Satine says, kind words indeed from a mindful and committed Jedi, which is the softest, nicest thing she said to him, right? About saying, like, I still don't think, you know, Jedi should be generals. I still think you have run into this war way too fast, but I see you, Obi-Wan. I see that you are trying to be the best in this situation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well done. It's making me think of a lot of the season 5 stuff. We'll get to that with Satine, but again, going back 4 or 5 years ago of just listening to a lot of Satine's words, I kind of remember the moment. And again, I didn't take big swings and misses in Star Wars, especially with the prequels. I wasn't there for a lot of it. I didn't see a lot of it. I wasn't open to a lot of the big questions that were being asked in the movie. Sometimes it's just easy to go, yeah, Jedis, lightsabers, generals, cool. I've absolutely, over the last 20 years, been guilty of that. And it was Satine. That's why I love this character so much. So many people love her. It was the words of Satine, especially in the season 5 stuff, where it just was like, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, why are Jedis generals? I never really thought about it, you know, even though George had been asking the question. But great stuff.
Yeah, and I think it is what makes these great all-ages shows, right? Because I would have watched these when I was 6 and just thought, this is so cool. And then, you know, you get older and you see what's kind of really at work in the plot. I think for me, one of the things that I really love about the whole arc, I love that second episode kind of as an episode. Mm-hmm. But the third episode is so important, I think, to this debate about what is a peacekeeper. Because ultimately what happens is, you know, Palpatine and the Death Watch try again to just, you know, straight up lie to the people, manipulate Satine, manipulate the people of the Republic, frame Satine. They try all this stuff, and she does manage to, no pun intended, stick to her metaphorical guns. Mm-hmm. She and Obi-Wan together demonstrate what Merrick is kind of saying can't be done, is that through nonviolent action, they are proactive. They do things, but they find information, and Obi-Wan really only uses violence as literal defense, and they actually do defuse the plot this time. And this episode then becomes like almost meta, right? Because there's always this great tension of, it's called Star Wars, and it is often preaching avoid war at all costs. In this episode has this great vibe of, it is building to what feels like it's going to happen halfway through the episode, is the Republic is going to occupy Mandalore. They're going to be a bunch of clones and Jedi, and then Death Watch, a Mandalorian army. They're going to have a big war on Mandalore, and it almost invites you as a fan to go like, all right, here we go. And then it diffuses that and says, nope, the better thing would be if you could find out, you know, just some political information and play a hologram in the Senate. That's the ideal situation, you know?
Yeah. Stop Massimeda and his lies at all costs. That's what I want.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think in some ways it's a little bit of sort of justice for the philosophical debates that Kenobi and Satine are having throughout. It's a counterpoint to Anakin's just like, what, he's going to blow up the ship, so I put a saber through his heart. They do take the time in the action to find a nonviolent solution to the immediate problem.
Stay to what defines you. Yeah, and what moves you forward. There you go, the theme. I love it.
I have one other kind of big picture idea I wanted to discuss, but do you have any other kind of big picture ideas, themes in these episodes you wanted to discuss?
No. I mean, there's definitely some stuff about attachment that connects, I think, to the bigger Star Wars stuff in a bit here. But yeah, hit me with your best shot there.
Yeah, I was really struck by just the idea of the knight seems to be being discussed. We've heard that since we were kids, of a Jedi knight, and that word knight obviously has like all this resonance in our real world. Sounds cool always.
Sure.
But right out of the gate in that first episode, there is this sense of irony about the romantic idea of a knight, right? The chivalrous hero who rides in. Satine's first lines are, well, Master Kenobi, my shining Jedi knight to the rescue once again.
Right.
You know, in Jedi knight, you know, more often than not nowadays, it's Jedi, and the knight kind of gets dropped, you know? Yeah, and even when you get into the ranks, like, well, technically Obi-Wan's a master right now, you know? So it gets dropped a lot, and it seems very purposeful that this starts with Satine having this sense of irony of, hey, maybe we should question some of these ideas of what makes someone a hero. You know, should you pride yourself on being, you know, a knight and running around the galaxy rescuing all the time? And it even gets enforced more when they're kind of talking in their great banter with a little bit of irony, sarcasm about the idea of a daring rescue, right? Where Satine says, I saved your life, you saved mine. And Obi-Wan says, yes, well, mine was the more daring of the two rescues. It's like they're really aware of this idea of what it is to be a knight. And I think Obi-Wan, in the third episode, there's even this little bit of, you know, early on in the third episode, Obi-Wan tries to intervene and help her before she's asked for help, and she gets upset.
Right.
And she says, like, well, you know, you're just running hither and yon, wielding a lightsaber with deadly force like you're on a crusade, which, you know, knights and crusades, put those together and you have some real world implications as well.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, Obi-Wan does end up being what I think is like the good version of a knight when Satine directly asks him for his help. And really all he does in the second half of the episode is physically, you know, uses any violence or action to defend her and himself and preserve life, and then just do what she asks him to do. Not what he thinks she wants. He's not, you know, kicking the door down going, I'm here, I'm the hero. He just does what she asks him to do, and that's what makes it work out.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love this idea of, I've been kicking around my head a lot too, of just the idea of often you know, a hero's journeys does begin with someone dreaming about being something bigger beyond themselves. And, you know, and you face all the obstacles and you can't get there. But along the way, you learn maybe, you know, war's not make one great is a big Star Wars one. Oh, you want to be a hero. And characters like, you know, Jon Snow and Luke Skywalker and all these, you know, heroes we're grown up with or now have in our lives. They have to really ask themselves, again, what defines that title? What's that about? And again, to go back to George and saying that in the original trilogy and really digging into it now and how they being the Jedi fell. I understand. I like what you're saying there. I'm right there with you on this idea of questioning it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought it was just cool that it was like the general idea of questioning the hero, questioning the war, questioning generals, questioning Jedi. That's always there. But this was just kind of this fun extra flavor that it really connected it to the idea of knights in shining armor.
Yeah.
You know, literally using my shining Jedi knight to the rescue once again, you know, and it does connect to a lot of other moments in Star Wars where heroes learn something different. Even like even Obi-Wan and Ezra in that great Rebels episode that we discussed that, you know, like even Obi-Wan is like, thank you, Ezra. I see that you really, really, really mean well, but you shouldn't even be here. I don't need you to write in and help me with this one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You're not supposed to be here.
Let's talk then about the ideas that reflect the larger story, morality, perspective of Star Wars and all that. You want to dig into attachment with me, Ken?
Let's go into attachment. Yes, Anakin's got some interesting advice on it. It seems like he's learned. He hasn't.
Yeah, yeah. So I love the little exchange. I love the whole time that Anakin seems excited like a kid in a candy store at the possibility, like, does Obi-Wan have a girlfriend? the whole way that story is told, the mirroring that a lot of it happens in elevators, it's great. Mm-hmm. But for me, I just really love that moment where Obi-Wan finally tells him a little bit more of the story. And Anakin says, as Master Yoda says, a Jedi must not form attachments. And Obi-Wan says, yes, but he usually leaves out the undercurrent of remorse.
Yeah.
Incredibly well-written, well-delivered line. What did you get out of that? How did you take that?
Man, I did write that down here, and trying to ruminate on it there. Just the idea of, we're seeing a lot of, in the High Republic too, the Light of Jedi and beyond plays with this idea of just like, can we allow ourselves to have these kind of emotions? And, is to me, there's the remorse is a bit of a burden, a bit of a scar. And how do you heal from that? And how do you move it? And are you just repressing it? And I think Obi-Wan can handle that kind of stuff, but you know, Anakin and many, many others, not only the Lost 20, but other Jedi along the way have probably questioned it and dealt it, and who knows, dealt with it and failed to deal with it. So that's where I went with it. It's just like he's saying it, even the angle of the camera, the slumped shoulders, it's a big giant burden on it, on him for me.
Yeah, I think that's what I really liked it about it, that it feels just realistic, you know, and I obviously everybody involved with the creative team is cool with it or wouldn't be in here. But that also that felt to me a little bit like, you know, Paul Denny trying to get into that, like the heart of like, OK, we learned all about the attachment thing, but what does that really mean for the Jedi? Yeah. What does that feel like? And I really like it from this perspective of Obi-Wan saying, yeah, I'm letting my guard down and I'm admitting that it hurts me that I can't be both a Jedi and with Satine because I want both those things. But sometimes that's what you have to do. You just have to admit that a negative feeling is real and you're not going to act on it and examine it and accept it. You know, he's saying it in his kind of his sarcastic way. And I don't think he's offering great insight to Anakin in that moment. But I think it is insightful for, you know, why Obi-Wan is ultimately kind of a Jedi hero of, he's like, yeah, no, I've been where you are, Anakin, with Padme, and it sucks. But sometimes things suck, and you can't fix them. And you just live with the remorse.
Yeah. You live with it. And it's you can process it a bit where Anakin's, you never really process it, or at least he does in a negative way.
Yeah, and it's, you know, another great element, I think, of Anakin's fall that gets developed of, like, he starts out in life as a mechanic, and, you know, he's got that great line in Attack of the Clones, is everything was easier when I was a kid, I could fix things. you know? And this is something Obi's like, yeah, this hurts. And it always lives in me, buried somewhere. And I can't fix it. And there's no point, you know, weep not for the past.
Yep.
I wanted to, in terms of attachment, I wanted to run this line by you because I think I think about it all the time. When they're being sort of held hostage by Merrick, and Satine gets into the, like, no, I'm going to tell you that I've always felt for you. And even Merrick's like, gross, guys. Yeah. But Obi-Wan has this line of, had you said the word, I would have left the Jedi Order. Mm. And, you know, I think it's the first time I heard that, it was just the like, wow, it's even possible that Obi-Wan would have left the Order. This is not just like a flirtation. This is deep. Mm-hmm. This is real. But I've, when I think back on it, I just love the way that it is. He's entirely putting the ball in her court, which is just a fascinating insight to like, this decision was too hard to make. So I decided that I would do something if you made the decision for me.
Are we mad at Obi-Wan for this?
I don't know if mad. I think it's just in insight. You know, I think that there can be in real life in many things, but certainly in romance, that like, you don't want to be the one who makes the declarative statement, particularly at the beginning of a relationship, because what if you're wrong? You know?
Yeah.
I think I just like it because it makes him human. I don't think it's a big he's right or wrong. Mm-hmm. It just makes him human. It's such a huge, huge decision as a young person to go, I'm going to tell Qui-Gon. I'm going to tell Yoda. I seem to like my life at the Jedi Temple for the most part. I'm just going to tell them as a teen that I'm walking away from it all, that that's too big or too scary of a decision for Obi-Wan to make himself. But he had decided that if she made the decision, he would agree with it, you know?
Yeah. What I've always loved about this moment is, and especially on this rewatch, is seeing seeing him kind of own the feeling, whether or not he would have or not, you know, and a great insight on putting on her shoulders. But I think I talked about the burden of remorse for him just to be like, I wonder if he's for years just been like, would I really have done that? Would I really have done that? And in this moment, he's like, yeah, I would have done that. And just finally, you know, whatever that does to help him process the past and move forward. I wonder if it's a bit of relief finally.
Yeah, to just say this out loud or, you know, yeah. And it is, I think it is utterly open for interpretation. Is this something that he was entirely aware of back then? Or is when he's thinking back now, he is realizing that that's what would have happened. Other big ideas from the old Star Wars morality perspective storyline that you feel are reflected in these episodes?
So I kept thinking about Kylo and Ben Solo, not just about them, that this just made me, let me think about that. It just the connection. We talk about these big connections and how, you know, these movies in 2015, 17 and 19 kind of dealt with this idea of you know who you are or what you are. And then when you are challenged with it, you adapt and perhaps lose your way. And to me, that's Kylo. I go to the Lor San Tekka in the beginning, the very beginning, saying, oh yeah, you know, basically, hey, you wear a mask, Cabe. I know what you think you are, Kylo Ren. I know what you really are. And not that we can't change or grow or that we have to, you know, I'm a Solo and that's my family. Like there's obviously bigger themes in there, but just the idea of, you know, the next picture, Kylo wants to destroy the past. Good and bad, we've talked about a lot, but to me, it's just he doesn't want to face what he is. He wants to stay stuck in what he is and where he is. And we know he goes so far down the path he can't comprehend nor believe turning back. But I go to this up top of that's this idea of learning from the past and then growing from it, and it all leading of really knowing who you are and knowing how you want to drive yourself forward. Kylo is an example of all these pressures on him, all these things and what he might be. And when it was challenged, you know, not right away, but when it was challenged, he adapted. And I just Satine's line of, you know, again, is reality what makes Jedi abandon his ideals or their ideals? Or is it simply a response to political convenience that I just I look at Kylo of like, man, you got burnt once, Ben. You got burnt once, and you reach for the black cape. For a lot of reasons, not just simple and Palpatine and Snoke are in his ear, but just it's this big kind of Star Wars thing of why the past is valuable, even if we want to move past it, and why you can't ignore it in any direction. And I just thought it stretches out along many Star Wars stories for me.
Yeah, no, I think that's really great, that idea that even when you're in personal turmoil, there might be something to learn, not even from your personal past, but just even the past of the people who came before you, you know, like his namesake.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan.
<yeah. laughs> Totally.
Yeah, I love that. I often like to keep track of the war, kind of what's going on in the war. You know, obviously the Separatists, the Sith, would love to get Mandalore on their side and turned against the Jedi. I'm sure that's the ultimate play is like, that's great. You know who else was really good at kicking Jedi ass? Mm. The Mandalorians. How can we move those chess pieces into position?
Yeah.
So I think that's what's going on ultimately there with the Sith. But in terms of trying to understand the Jedi perspective of why did they fall into this trap, I thought there's just some great clarity in this episode. In these episodes, Satine's got this great, seeing it from outside, she can see it with more clarity than even, you know, our heroes like Obi-Wan and Padme and Mon Mothma, where she's got this line where she says, "War is intolerable. We have been deceived into thinking we must be a part of it. I say the moment we committed to fighting, we already lost."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she is saying that, I think, about Mandalore, but also about the larger Republic.
Yeah.
And we as audience know that's ultimately true because we know this war wasn't necessary. Palpatine made it happen. Any actual grievances with the Republic could have been handled with diplomacy. And we know that, you know, by watching the adventures of Padme and Bail Organa and Mon Mothma. And we'll see more of that in the Clone Wars. Mm-hmm. And then Obi-Wan counters with what I think is the like big picture perspective of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. He says, and yet some might argue that the strongest defense is a swift and decisive offense. You know, he's just, we've seen it as we've been going through these episodes where the Jedi are like, no, we can end this war quickly. Like the Separatists are attacking. Mm-hmm. So we have to defend the innocent, you know, people of the Republic who are being attacked. And then we can just end it real quick. And it's great that you can really see where the Jedi are coming from, but also know, you know, from the perspective of the audience, with the knowledge we have that they don't, that Satine is right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I put down this note. I hope it ties to this a little bit here. It really comes down to the Mandalorians needing to act out of safety, not pride attached to anything in their past, too, and all that kind of there as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's so much great stuff about, you know, who should the Mandalorian people be? You know, did they lose anything becoming pacifist? And at least in this episode, we see that Satine is absolutely willing to take action. She is not, you know, she's a pacifist. She is not passive. The people advocating for the warrior ways of Mandalorians are not, I think, portrayed as great people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of lies. And that's my last thing for this is, I like that third episode is just so much about reminding you about watch out for lies, manipulation, misinformation. It's really a great micro and macro version of showing that any notion that is just like, you know, defending someone who is in trouble or taking a small act of violence for the greater good, those ideas that you could say are just are so easily twisted and perverted by bad actors like Palpatine. And I think this episode is such a great reminder of that. And it's such a bittersweet moment when at least this time Palpatine's plot got foiled. And while it's being foiled and while, you know, it's foiled by Satine getting the truth. Satine and Obi-Wan getting the truth and just like literally broadcasting the truth. And while that is happening, we get this montage of the wise leaders of Padme and Mon Mothma and Rio Chuchi, who we met earlier. And it is this heartbreaking, it's kind of fist bumping, like, yeah, take that, Palpatine. Your lie didn't work this time.
This time.
This time. Yeah.
Any other thoughts before we take a break and get into the second half?
No. There's a lot, and there's so many specific things to focus on too that you can gravitate. And I just, I really took a turn into that introspective, find out who you are, type of thing, and know it, and then it will. You might not be back to back with blasters in a droid, discombobulator, whatever that weapon was, but you'll be challenged, and how you grow is kind of up to you, I think. So good, powerful stuff, big stuff, deep stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Big, deep, and powerful. And I think it's a deactivator, but I wish it was a decombobulator.
That's good. We need that.
So everyone go ahead and take a chance to grab your own droid decombobulator, and we will be back in just a minute.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Four Center friends, make sure you're keeping up to date on all the great content from Jennifer Landa. Whether it's YouTube, Instagram, or TikTok, you whippersnappers, Four Center's own Jennifer Landa continues to bring you fun, informative, and insightful laughs and moments.
Also, Jennifer brings her experience and perspective as a Star Wars loving mother to her DIY projects, blogs, and more. So be sure to head on over to jennylanda.com. That's JENILANDA.com for articles like how to make your own Darth Maul sneakers or 10 unique Star Wars baby gift ideas.
Follow Jen on Twitter and Instagram at Jennifer Landa and on TikTok as Jennifer Landa 1138.
And we are back to finish our discussion of the Great Mandalore arc in Season 2 of Clone Wars. We're going to talk about some of our favorite moments, some of the big canon stuff. We're starting with the action. Ken, did you have some favorite action moments in this arc about pacifism?
Yay, good point. Yes, I did. Let's see what we got here. I put some just big general ones because... No, I got take that back. I got some specific ones. I just love... I marked it in the first episode, but really it's all through this and through all his career. I do love Obi-Wan Kenobi fist fighting an armored man or droid. It happens often. And sometimes it works. Good, well-placed kick or punch works. And sometimes in this episode a few times, or I'm thinking General Grievous and that leg kick and Revenge of the Sith, it doesn't work. But he, by golly, he's always going to try. And that I love.
Yeah, he has not seen a helmet. He won't punch. He does just, yeah, this is rock'em sock'em Obi-Wan, right? He's just constantly punching the Mandalorians in this arc.
Yeah, I love that. And a great moment. I love when he shoots the rocket pack and it explodes and takes out two Death Watch.
Yeah, that was such a great moment of Obi-Wan being clever, right? And taking the having the patience to look at the situation, look at resources, and work with what he's got. So I love that one. I really love Obi-Wan being trapped on the industrial conveyor belt, Satine coming to rescue him. But the conveyor belt thing, you know, these episodes are such political thrillers with such kind of dense, fun, intriguing real-world stuff and all the romance and all the philosophy of... what is a peacekeeper? But then even within that, this is such an old serial cliffhanger. This is out of James Bond, 60s Batman. It's like, I'm on a conveyor belt and I'm going to be smashed is so old serial pulpy that I really liked that that was, you know, still present in this episode.
Yeah, love that.
And then you highlighted the great rocket pack moment. I love in the Vizsla and Obi-Wan fight, you know, great reveal of the Darksaber. We'll talk about that in the canon. But I like the way that that whole thing is paced, that Pre Vizsla is good and he is making Obi-Wan work to the top of his game. But Obi-Wan still does have the Force on his side and he kicks Vizsla's ass. And this is one of the moments where I really like, you know, there isn't a big argument in these episodes that the warrior ways have nobility to them because Vizsla's being a coward and a jerk. He starts this fight by shooting the Mando he thinks is a failure. Then Obi-Wan kicks his ass and then he ends the fight by saying, "You three get him." Who's the big Mandalorian warrior now? Like he's portrayed as a coward ultimately, you know?
Yeah. And good old fashioned Force Center hubris, get the, you know, the blade, everything. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff there. And then in the second episode, man, the creepy scenes down in the hold with the assassin probe. And in particular, the moment where it's puppeteering the clone Red Eye. Oh, great, creepy stuff.
So great. Absolutely great. And just the design of that, the look, I mean, it's animation, but it looks so realistic each step. It's kind of one of those. I kind of forgot about it, too, from back in the day. And I was watching it here just kind of like, what? Oh, wait. Yeah. Totally love it. Great stuff. And in that whole sequence, I just love, you know, not for nothing, just Anakin leaping around. Lightsabers going into places. It's pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, it's a fun episode because Anakin isn't the focus. And sometimes, you know, I love Anakin focused episodes, but sometimes it's fun to just see him as the, like, yeah, the, you know, brave Jedi Knight who just can handle anything, you know, and he's just down there getting his work done, cutting things apart.
Yeah.
And in particular, he's got that great saber throw, which is, you know, very, very similar to Vader's saber throw toward Luke in Return of the Jedi. So that was another fun, like, oh, yeah, that's a cool action moment. And it connects back to he's a long term fan of the saber throw.
Yes. he knows what defines him and how to go forward with that saber throw.
Last action beat for me is in that second episode when Obi-Wan and Satine do come back to back fighting the littler spider droids. And, you know, I was trying to take a screenshot of that and it happens real fast. And I was like doing frame by frame.
Yeah.
And they look at each other quickly. There is, you know, there's the great exchange of that dialogue of, hey, this is kind of what a Jedi does. As you know, we're pacifists who will defend ourselves. But there's clearly this moment where they're remembering their youth, right? Like, this is what the kind of moments that brought them together. And I love that it happens fast. It's subtle, but it is, forgive me, a sexy action moment.
It's great. No, it's I love the description of the past of eating, you know, hand to mouth on the run. And here it is. You're going to I love that. It's again,
you can feel it.
Yeah. You can feel it. It's romantic in a way. America. No. Anakin has says that, right? It's something about that too. Love that.
Oh yeah. Any other action moments for you?
Yeah, I do. I do love in the third episode again. The fight of Duchess Satine's on the run and she shoots a droid at one point, and it's a pretty damn good shot. I love that little sequence there. And just Kenobi kind of defending Satine. She can hold her own, right? But he's doing some great stuff in a lot of the sequences going on there. Just big stuff. These three episodes really have so much classic Star Wars action. Swashbuckling, whiz bang, deep philosophy. There's a reason these three hit so well.
Yeah, and you're right. That fight with the assassin in that third episode is good stuff too. It's more Obi-Wan punching.
Yeah.
Punching Mandalorians who have clearly been trained to disarm whenever possible, to disarm the Jedi. But it always has a great tension for me, especially the first time I watched it, not knowing the rest of the story and feeling like, well, Obi-Wan, you have to protect her. She can die, you know?
Yeah. Right. Absolutely.
Okay. So moving on from action moments to moments of comedy, whimsy, weirdness. Oh, man, it was hard to try to narrow these down because the banter is so good. But Ken, what do you got? What are your favorite moments of comedy, whimsy, weirdness?
Yeah. There's some general things going on here, but some of the lines, there's some Satine lines I'm definitely going to let you have on your list there. I love the whole dinner sequence with Pre Vizsla, which has got that great painting behind, but just the Duchess getting Kenobi on the radio, you know, secretly. It's just good old hijinks.
Yeah.
Good old, good old comedy, suspense thriller. Because, like, Kenobi's in peril, but it's the tone is a little different and it's fun in that whole sequence. It's some even Indiana Jones ish to me, which I've said before in this episode, but like the whole thing about it. So I just love that she's on the radio playing along, answering Obi-Wan while also answering Pre Vizsla is just fun.
Yeah, no, I think it is well done. And I think, it's great, great relationship tension there too. I think one of my first ones that I had to write down is the Satine saying, I have to tell you, I'm opposed to all of this. And Obi-Wan saying, I'd be disappointed if you weren't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It really establishes their relationship and that question of kind of when to take action, when not to take action. Obi-Wan is being really assertive. He is really like, my mandate from the Jedi, not the Republic, from the Jedi, is to figure out what's going on, and I'm going to figure it out. And you feel like, Obi-Wan, you're pushing too hard. But at the same time, but he's totally right. The Death Watch is a big problem.
Yeah.
and he needs to expose it, you know?
Love that.
And then in that Indiana Jones rescue sequence, which I think you're so right. Indiana Jones is a great way to describe that whole sequence is when they're bickering and Obi-Wan doesn't think she's moving fast enough and he's getting to be grumpy, impatient Obi-Wan. And Satine says, I haven't saved you yet.
Yes. It was just, I haven't saved you yet. Oh, well, press the button.
Yeah. So great stuff there. Another moment for me in the first episode is there's this little burst of heroic music as Obi-Wan stands up to fight the revealed Death Watch Mandalorian warriors, and he goes to grab his lightsaber that isn't there.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a funny moment. I love it when the music gets to get the laugh line, basically. But it's also just this great reinforcement of what Satine's arguing of, like, you've gotten really used to just constantly being in war. Just like you're always going for the lightsaber and it's not there this time. Not there.
Indiana Jones like as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah. And I'll jump into the one that I know we need to talk about from the second episode of Satine saying, Senators, I presume you're acquainted with a collection of half-truths and hyperbole that is Obi-Wan Kenobi. Great line, followed by a little bit of banter. And then we see Anakin's take at their banter was just like, damn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I've sensed something in my master and old friend Obi-Wan about her, but now I'm seeing the sparks fly and in front of all these senators. Damn. Yeah.
With looks and everything. Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Line itself is amazing and worthy of discussion, but Anakin's take of realizing, damn, this is real, is really the cherry on top of this scripting Sunday.
It's a great line, great sequence. I realize as I'm looking at my notes, there's a lot of looks. There's a lot of great looks. Kenobi in that elevator when Anakin's kind of like, hey, so this isn't the best time, but thank your girlfriend, basically. And Kenobi just has this kind of like gives him a look. A lot of the look Anakin gives him after killing Merrick. There's a lot of just takes, a lot of looks, a lot of double takes. I love it. That's a lot of great comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that super defensive. I knew her.
Yes.
Because Anakin's like, did you have I knew her. And then that great beat where Anakin says, you go save your girlfriend. Yeah. She's not my. Yeah. Great comedy between the two of them. This Satine line, the collection of half-truths and hyperbole. You know, I think there's a part of me that at some point in my life, I would have said, that's too self-aware. That's too much of a character saying what we, the fans, have come to say about Obi-Wan, right?
Right, right, right.
Because, you know, Return of the Jedi comes out and Obi-Wan offers this truth to Luke that, you know, we cling to our points of view. Many truths we cling to depend greatly on our point of view. And Luke pushes back, and then, you know, Obi-Wan really makes the argument and helps Luke see the wisdom. But then we as fans are like, have this debate that still goes on. Is like, that's not a point of view. Obi-Wan straight up lied to him in A New Hope, and he's shady, and he's a jerk. And like, all of those sort of debates, I feel like, are summed up in this line. And I think at a time in my life, I would have been like, that's too meta. Now with age and a different point of view, I love that is just sort of canonized as a part of his character in somebody who loves him, I think, and sees him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a frustration that you'd have with him of like, but you are always going kind of, ooh, but what if we turn it around and look this way? And always kind of trying to, you know, poke and prod and see it from another perspective and twist it around and exaggerate to win an argument. And it feels accurate to his character. It feels like that is a part of who he is. And this is a really salty way for a loved one to call him out.
Yes. Oh, you know me well. I totally see where you come from too. Of just like one point, this might've been too much, but I think over time, just in a serious way, we talk about that Leia moment. We've dug really deep into Leia putting the blanket on Luke and everything and how, that's just something we've always talked about, but to have it kind of, like you said, kind of cemented in canon of just part of who they are, part of the character arcs, it helps me really just connect these stories and just make these characters have traits and strengths and weaknesses. And so to really, you know, it's almost like, and he sits on logs a lot. He loves to relax. it's just fun. It's fun. And it's part of the spirit of being a Star Wars fan while also creating Star Wars, I guess. You get to kind of answer those questions directly.
Yeah, and not to make it all about Obi-Wan, I think part of the reasons that I've come to love it is it tells us so much about Satine, right? She is, we get right away that she is extremely sharp and, a true leader. But this is what really almost sets her apart, right? This is a moment where we get to see that she is committed to pacifism, but again, not passive, right? Like, this is a person who is not going to hold back. She's frustrated with Obi-Wan. She's frustrated with the way he's pushing her and making his arguments. So she's going to push back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Great stuff. What are other comedy moments for you?
There's a little one here. I think it's a second episode where Kenobi uses the Force to bring that chair back, and like, I love it. Yeah, this is why we all want Force powers, really. You know, move the TV remote closer to me. Yeah, no, that's what I would do. So I feel it's one of the more realistic Obi-Wan moments ever.
It's just so intuitive, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I know to this day, I've seen friends on social media, and I guess fans of Star Wars continue to make the argument that that's a bad thing in the prequels, that the use of the Force becomes mundane. Like, they don't like it when he uses the Force to close the door on Padme's ship in Revenge of the Sith. Mm-hmm. But like here, it's kind of funny, but it's also just, it's like he's just totally in his head and he's just like, I can't even deal with what's going on and I need to sit down. And it's so instinctual. It's almost just like I'm having a hard day and I need to sit down, and, you know, by the will of the Force, there'll be a chair under me when I collapse.
Yeah, no, totally. No, look, the Obi-Wan closing the door thing. I don't know. That's one of those, I'm definitely not insulting your friends, but it's like one of those paper thin cliche, you know, YouTube breakdowns of the Phantom Menace type of that. Yeah, that held water for about 5 minutes. None of it really does when you dig into it. Again, you know, Ken, what would your Force power be? I'd move my chair or pull my blankets up so I don't have to do it. Like, this is what I would do. So that's why I actually love it even more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it is a view of the Force that it is all around us, you know, and it is natural to reach out and use. It's not, it is sacred, but it's sacred because it's everywhere, because it's all of us, because it's between you, me, the chair, and my anxiety.
Yeah, what does Obi-Wan gain by moving that chair by himself? You know, does he stay true to who he is? Is that the lesson? Is the lesson here that you Jedi move chairs now, therefore they've lost their way? I don't know. Maybe it is, but maybe.
Now, look, if this was a video game and I had one of those annoying Force meters and I was going to run out of Force powers, I'd question moving the chair. Yeah. But also, I love that it also makes him clearly a little bit of a hypocrite. that great scene with when Anakin says, people will disagree with me on great, but the scene in Attack of the Clones, the dinner scene where, you know, Anakin is floating fruit and he'd say, Obi-Wan would be very grumpy if he saw me do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh, Obi-Wan. Being a bit of a hypocrite. another moment of banter. I could write down the whole script pretty much, but the one I really liked is after that conflict in the second episode with the droids, and Obi-Wan says, I distinctly remember carrying you to safety. And Satine says, yes, I met the scar I got after you fell and dropped me. And Obi-Wan says, oh, yes. Oh, yeah. That's just such a it's a funny line all by itself, but it's such a beautiful picture of young, heroic Padawan Obi-Wan trying to be, you know, the shining Jedi who is protecting Satine. Mm-hmm. And it also just says so much about their relationship and the intimacy of being on the run, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just a ton to that. So I love that.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to be sure to get your take on is the whimsy of the bridge of that ship, the Coronet, that it is just straight up, no bones about it, an old seafaring vessel. Dude's got the captain hat and the weird facial hair and the steering wheel helm. Just straight up, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean and real life too. I know, but what was that too much for you? That like this spaceship is just it's a sea ship.
And I think the bridge is made of wood. I think like some really fine buffed wood. It's almost too much. It's not too much to like crumple up the paper and walk out of the meeting, but like Star Wars does this though. We're gonna have you next week on the main show. We'll probably talk about Jackson a little bit because of the toys announced recently. And I've always, it's a rabbit. It's a rabbit in space. And I love that Kevin Scott loves his character. And I love that Kevin Scott wrote that short story from a certain point of view for the Empire book where even Jackson's like, what's wrong with me? You got squid walking around. So, you know, that's the Meeber Gascon of it all. Do I not like that? Do I like him as a frog and hate Riff Tamson as a shark? It's just Star Wars going back to the beginning. So yes, all that to say, I can't not see it. I'll just say that I can't. Every time I see it, I'm like, it's a ship.
A ship. I totally forgot, and I was just delighted. I was just like, are they going to start doing some, like, sea shanties for TikTok?
Yeah.
It's so beautifully on the nose.
Yeah, Yeah, yeah.
But it does fit the rest of the aesthetic of the coronet. So I think that, that works for me. Do you have any other moments of comedy or whimsy?
A big one, big final one. We talked about the big moment with Merrick and the big moral choice and the moral dilemma. And, you know, Anakin takes care of that. But I just love what he's just like laying it out Bond villain style. I'm just like, oh, well, so now I might kill Obi-Wan, which means Satine, you would kill me to save him and vice versa. And then when he says it to Kenobi, he's like, you know, if you kill me, you'd be a violent, violent man. Everyone would thank you. Oops, except for one person. And it's so comical. It's so Bondy, villain-like, and I love it. Again, Greg Proops, great comic, great improv comic, whose line, and of course, Phantom Menace, Fodes, not Bede, right? Fodes, or is he Bede? Anyway, he's Fodes, right?
I always forget which one is Fode and which one is Bede.
Yeah. I love that little moment, that great read of that beat.
Yeah, and I mean, it fits everything that's at stake in the episode, but it is also like, it seems like the character Merrick is just sort of relishing, like, you could kill me, and you probably would, but then your girlfriend would be mad at you. It's so dickish. And it works really, really well, I think. Ultimately, all right, so moving along to canon and lore connections to other stories. A big reason to revisit these episodes right now is that little show called The Mandalorian, right? This is big Mandalore on screen, establishing a bunch of different things. Yeah. I just wanted to check in on what you thought about like the design and the sort of culture of actually seeing Mandalore, you know, the domes and the boxes and all that. What did you think of that?
So I've always loved this. And this is where, Ken doesn't read Legends or EU stuff. I think it helps me. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. I know a lot of people question this when this popped up. Well, that's not what we've been reading about and not what we've thought. And there's some great quotes. You all can find them if I'm sure we've even read them or discussed them before, of just Filoni talking about, well, that's all George, and they were supposed to be super commandos, and Boba and Jango were kind of rogue. The Mandalorians were never supposed to be bounty hunters. That just kind of came out of Boba Fett in the 80s, and Jango would reinforce that. But then just the look of Mandalore, I wasn't expecting anything. So when I got this, I was intrigued, and the whole the care and detail into the production design and the animation and just everything about it and those shots, it's some of the most beautiful stuff in Clone Wars entirely. So I've always loved it. I understand some of the bigger pushback or just questions about it, but that's also George being George in a lot of ways. No, this is what I already always intended to deal with it. And then a little bit later on, 2019, we deal with it.
Yeah. So
I like it. I like it. I love the conversation around it.
Yeah, no, me too. And I think it makes these episodes really fun to re-experience. I've always loved the design of the, you know, weird dome cities. And then almost everything inside is very boxy, very designed. It's very rigid, but it is also very artistic and has this just a clear sense of tradition. You know, even the trees' leaves are cut into cubes. You know, I think it was, you know, one of the behind the scenes for Revenge of the Sith, maybe even that video series they put out, the internet as it was coming out, where Lucas was talking about Utapau and like, you know, I really wanted to give a lot of thought to what would your culture be if you lived in a sinkhole? And he was so passionate about that. And it's always great to see that passion translated through the whole team for designing a world and a culture to match. And I just kind of love that. There's something that makes perfect sense about Mandalore, this ancient place with a sense of like great honor that's been scarred by war.
Yeah.
And there, the way that translates into design is basically, you know, what if Picasso had Lego?
Yeah.
And he would build this place, you know, and there's the Cubist painting of Satine, and in Pre Vizsla's office, there's the Guernica like painting that just, you know, sharp edges, clear lines, and this is the way we've done it for a long time,
right?
Really makes sense for the Mandalorians, but there's art to it as well.
A boxy elegance. Yes,
a boxy elegance, which makes a ton of sense. And in totally inelegant news, Greg Proops is Fode. I looked it up, so
He is.
You don't have to be tortured. He's Fode, not Bede. Important question answered and trivia studied for live on air.
I think Kenobi would say both of us, your instincts serve you well.
Yes, yes. So I want to talk about a couple of the specific moments that are relevant to all of our Mandalorian speculation and discussion. We get the line from Olmec, who says, Jango Fett was a common bounty hunter. How he acquired that armor is beyond me. How does that sit with you now when you're revisiting this episode, knowing we've now had this further conversation where Jango, or rather Boba, is saying, you know, my father was given this armor. He was, you know, basically adopted into the culture of Mandalore.
Yeah, we had some great discussions during the Mandalorian report episodes, right? But now to actually see this and study it, and it's very weird to just see this Almec quote in context of the episode. And I think I'd say maybe we as fans maybe took this at face value for a long time, because this was kind of the belief that this came from George. Again, a lot of quotes, but also to better serve the story, I look at this now and I just point at the screen like that Leo DiCaprio meme and say, that dude is lying. I see it right there. He's lying. Everything about it, nothing about it rings true, which doesn't mean it wasn't intended to be true at any point. I mean, this is the fun of Star Wars and the Star Wars story continuing. There's nothing honest about Almec, right?
Yeah.
He's,
I mean,
listen, and shady and hiding. So, yeah, his gut reaction, no.
No, I totally agree with you. It's so great to see it again in the context of the episode, because what's at stake in the episode in particular at this point is, you know, there's this rumor planted by someone that the Mandalorians are gearing up to side with the Separatists. That's why Obi-Wan's there, is this question hanging over them of, are the Mandalorians people of violence or not? Mm-hmm. And so when Obi-Wan's like, I ran into a Mandalorian recently, it makes a lot of sense that Olmec would push back. And then what happens throughout the episode is Satine keeps being betrayed by Mandalorians that she thinks she can rely on. You know, she thinks that she's got a good relationship with Pre Vizsla. She thinks she's got a good relationship with Tal Merrick.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually Olmec is going to betray her too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Long game here. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Because, that doesn't play out much yet. So even then, going back to this, the year we're watching this, you know, you don't get the meat and payoff for it.
Yeah, but I take your point too of like, it's, you don't even have to look that up on Wikipedia. You can just sense that this is a defensive, not entirely trustworthy guy's point of view.
Yeah. And look, you could be like, he's frustrated. Oh gosh, Jango again. Yes. We always hear about it. No. He does not represent us. But yeah, it's just everything about it is anger and flash and passion and a lie. So yeah, I accept it as the story goes on. It's interesting to revisit that, and it's fun to just watch it now.
Yeah. So there you go. Olmec, he has the truth from his point of view. Mm-hmm. But Boba and Jango have their point of view too, and we're going to be finding out more about it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we go to the Darksaber.
Yeah.
And we got Vizsla saying, this lightsaber was stolen from the Jedi Temple during the fall of the Old Republic. Since then, many Jedi have died upon its blade. How did it hit you to see the Darksaber now that it is in shells at Target?
Right. Great. And also just fun to see that it's there's not much beyond that line, right? That gets filled in more in Rebels and just down the line and to where we are now with the Din looking at it going, why do I have this? I don't want this. I don't want this. Fun and how you can I think you can, the tip of the iceberg storytelling phrase we use here, just that's what that was. That was just a tip of a story that wasn't yet fully told. And when the time was right, Filoni said, you know what we could do? Let's go back and tell that story. And I just love how that works. Again, a lot of what we're talking about here, even with Jango or Mandalore itself.
Yeah. These ideas can be thrown out and then, you know, they get, they evolve. Mm-hmm. Or get adapted over time, or we learn that they're just one character's point of view. That stuff is, I think, a part of the fun of Star Wars storytelling, of not knowing the whole truth and getting to wonder for a while. And even with the amount that we've learned about the Darksaber, there's still just a lot of, I found myself just still excited by, you know, the things that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And just this line was a great reminder for the sake of this episode that, you know, the Jedi and Sith have this history of conflict and violence. And that's a part of what is, you know, animating everything. There's such disdain for the Jedi of like this implication that, you know, mm-hmm. this is the Darksaber, you know, belongs to us and we mm-hmm. use it to kill you. That's what it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's this great symbol of honor that mm-hmm. will most likely be motivating Mandalorian season 3 as far as we can see. Or maybe Mandalorian season 3 just opens up and everybody is at a bonfire because they decided to destroy the Darksaber. Why not? Couple other canon things. None as big. We got more BD-3000 luxury droids. They are everywhere in the Clone Wars.
Yep.
Yep. We got the gauntlet fighters and transports. I absolutely love those ships. One of my favorite Star Wars designs. Where do you land on the gauntlet fighters, Ken?
Wait, remind me. These are the ones that...
These are the foldy wings.
The foldy wings. For some reason, I was thinking of the flying thumbtacks that infiltrate ships. No, I do really love those, and it is fun to see them in live action. Yeah, it's an underrated design in a way. I know a lot of people are big fans, but, you know, you don't think about it when you're listing the ships, and it was fun to see them again, for sure.
Yeah. Then we got deep-fried Nuna legs. That's nice. They seemed like they came off larger Nunas to me.
Yeah, super-sized Nunas.
Super-sized Nunas. And more Mon Mothma background walking in the Senate, which she does a lot, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I put that down as well. Just fun to see Mon walking around, getting ready to lead a rebellion.
Yeah. Anything else for canon connections that you wanted to discuss?
I just put a bunch of these kind of concepts of, first of all, it was to have Padme kind of be handing down the news to Satine that, look, if this doesn't go right, you know, the Republic will occupy your planet. That Padme saying that and knowing what she dealt with the Trade Federation carries some weight to me. Just a thing that means a little bit more meaning, has more meaning in the Star Wars story. Anakin just being really interested in Kenobi's past is just one of those big moments of when someone's really concerned. Well, okay, but what happened when you did that? Was there any problems when you had a secret love? Any Kenobi might already be clued in at this point, of course. I think we believe that, but I just love that. That's a big connection to me, just to what's coming and both the tragedy and the fun of it all. But just to have him just be me, you know, me thinks doth protest too much here.
Yeah, I really love it because it is a bittersweet road not taken. It mm-hmm. does seem like Anakin wants the information, and if Obi-Wan was more on his game for seeing what Anakin needed, that he could have, you know, used this as a way to have a healthy conversation. And we'll get to it eventually in season 6, I believe, when Anakin's having some more Rush Clovis anger. There's a great moment where Obi-Wan does kind of try to, like, you know, I had feelings for Satine. It's okay to have these feelings. It's, you know, what we do about them. And Anakin's not in a place to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. He's not having it, but he could have here, you know?
Yeah. 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 Right.
So sad. So sad. Any other canon moments?
No, other than just kind of the big revelations, Kenobi leaving the Jedi Order and him and Satine, just we kind of discussed all that, but it's big connections and part of the thrill of these episodes. It wasn't just the action. It was like, what? The perfect Jedi Kenobi would have left? Like, it's great fun stuff.
Yeah, totally humanizes our good old Obi-Wan Kenobi. Was there anything in these episodes that you disliked or questioned?
I mean, if I can get over the actual ship in space, I'm okay. But no, just in terms of writing and execution of these stories, they're inspired so many fans for a reason. And to go back and analyze them here was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I love the entire arc. That second episode in particular, I love what it does for the big story of the Clone Wars, what it does for Mandalore, what it does for Kenobi, introducing this amazing character of Satine. The only thing for me was just extremely small things, and it's really interesting to watch, you know, now that these episodes are like, you know, they're 10 years old, that every once in a while there's a joke where I feel like, we probably don't do that as much. You know, there's a joke about Orin Freetod's legendary appetite, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of arm grabbing where Satine is trying to walk away and Obi-Wan grabs her arm. And, you know, some of that is that tradition of, you know, Star Wars pulls from classic Hollywood. I think that's, we've talked about it. It's got an old Hollywood romance vibe between Satine and Obi-Wan. And a part of it is that sort of, you know, if you're pulling from a source material, sometimes you just sort of update these ideas.
Yeah.
But it did affect me. I feel like if this was made now, Obi-Wan would not quite be doing as much arm grabbing.
Jostled her around. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, yeah. But those are minor things looking back on it is not only great episodes of Star Wars, but something that was made at a specific time and everything evolves, but absolutely great episodes. Is there anything that we have not talked about that you wanted to touch on?
There was. Oh, well, I put down this might have been a loose connection. Just Anakin at one point says that's a very remarkable woman, which is very true. And you said introducing this great character, Satine, and Padme and Satine and have Obi-Wan and Kenobi have these two remarkable women in their lives to have them constantly learn from, be challenged by. And, you know, as tragic as some of the stories were, I love that. I love that they both have these characters in their lives. And Satine is a spectacular character. The other thing I put down here is Satine. I think you said it one way. I've said it one way. I've said it otherwise. The show has said it a couple different ways. Satine cries. Satine cries. Satine cries. Also, she says, you've met Governor Vizsla. And Kenobi answers, oh, Vizsla. Star Wars just loves doing it. I'm convinced it just loves it. And it makes it difficult for us sometimes when you're making videos and you put a tribute to Duchess Satine cries. I remember I called Alex Dave and I was like, how do you say it?
Yeah. No, I was determined to try to say it right, and it still came out wonky at the top of this episode, because I think in the episode they say Kreese.
Yeah.
But there's something about that Y that makes me feel like I can't say Kreese. There's a Y in there.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say maybe that one's considered more standard now, but again, we say Pre Vizsla because Pre Viz, the designing, you know, of characters, everything, it's a great inside joke. The early visualization of the story why am I forgetting the term? But you know what I mean. Designing the character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Storyboards. There. I went to film school. But to have her, I made a note because she's just like, oh, Governor Vizsla. I'm like, oh, well, okay. That's different.
I'm so glad that you point that out. And I'll try Duchess Satine Kreese. There, I said it. I can make myself ignore the Y. Sure. Yeah. And I can't wait until we do our Rebels rewatch to get all the way to Ian McDiarmid saying Ashoka.
Exactly. That's good, Ian. That's good. The car's out front.
You do you, Ian. That's fine. We don't care. Go for it. That's names in Star Wars. I wanted to shout out Anna Graves, her performance.
Yes.
Also, you know, I know that there are a lot of fans that this relationship between Obi-Wan and Satine means a lot to people. You know, great stories from James Arnold Taylor and Anna Graves about the interactions they've had with people at conventions, about how much these characters, this romance means to people. And I just absolutely adore it. I absolutely love it. As a big fan of Obi-Wan, I think she is a character who's an absolutely fabulous character by herself. And it's great that we got some episodes coming up where Obi-Wan's not around and it's Satine interacting with other people. And Satine is a great character all by herself, but she adds so much to Obi-Wan. And sometimes when I think about Obi-Wan and have like just total fun headcanon of why did Obi-Wan do that? What was going through Obi-Wan's mind? It's really fun for me to look at different moments of Obi-Wan through his whole life and go, is he checking in on what Satine would think?
Mm.
Like, I think he truly loved her and I think he truly respected her so much. And I think he had that great, she sees me. She sees everything about me, from the best things about me to, you know, the moments where I'm full of half-truths and hyperbole. She knows me. You know, what would she say? How would she push me? If I was about to make this choice, would Satine go, is that the right choice, Obi-Wan? Like, I think he's checking in with Satine in his mind a lot.
I love that take. That's great.
All right. We shall move on then to our final question. If you could have a figure of any character from the episode, who would you want, Ken?
I, you know, sometimes try to be cute and funny. You know, other times it's just an actual one. I think more Duchess Satine figures. She's got a lot of, you know, little potential outfits to have some figures on. So I would do that. But I definitely think you need, unfortunately, it's tragic, but you do need a, you know, red eye controlled by Droid. A playset.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would love one of those assassin probes with spring up spider and repressed emotion action. I think that would be absolutely great. I'd mm-hmm. be all for that. Yeah, the Satine thing. I would absolutely love a Satine action figure. And in particular, what I'd never noticed without watching these episodes with the eye, we watch them as we do these reviews and discussions, is my Satine action figure, I want her to come with a deactivator,
yeah.
but she drinks a lot of martini, space martini drinks
yeah.
in the just classic martini glass. So if there's a Satine action figure, she has got to come with at least four martini glasses.
Go with that drinking Kenobi figure. Yeah.
That's right. Yep. I got a Kenobi drinking figure, and now I need a Satine drinking figure. All right. Next up, Ken, we're going to be discussing the final arc of season two. It's episodes 20, 21, and 22, Young Boba Fett Seeking Revenge on Mace Windu. So looking forward to watching those and discussing those. Ken, what should the moral of this episode of our podcast be?
The moral of this one should be the Force Center podcast you were does not need. Mean it's the Force Center podcast. It is.
I love that. That is some good Jedi wisdom. Where can people find us?
You can find me. No, not me. That's us. You said us. You can find us at Force Center Pod on Twitter. We are Instagram and YouTube. You can like our Facebook page. You can also get an audiobook on us by going to audibletrial.com/Force Center. And don't forget to get some merch, including our Speculate Responsibly t-shirt at tpublic.com/user/Force Center. You can support us directly at patreon.com/Force Center. I, because there's an I in Force Center, there isn't. You can I can be found over at Kednapsuck or Kednapsuck.com. Joseph, where can you? There's a you. Oh, there's not even a you in Force Center. Where can it be?
There's the British spelling, right? Force. Cool. That has no one doesn't. Yeah. Tried. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Joseph Scrimshaw, and you can check out my website, josephscrimshaw.com, for all of my other comedy adventures. Ken and I get so excited talking Star Wars, all these different ways to pronounce names. We get a little tongue-tied every once in a while, but that is all part of the fun. Thank you for listening as we get really excited about this great arc of the Clone Wars. But for now, for myself, for Ken, for Duchess Satine Kreese, this has been the Clone Wars Report.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.